From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Trump administration is touting a new one-on-one trade deal with South Korea. Here's White House trade advisor Peter Navarro today on NPR's Morning Edition.
Today's news, which is historic, it illustrates that we can have trade peace with our major allies in a way which not only ensures economic security with Korea, but also national security. This is an agreement that's really going to bring us closer together as two nations.
Meanwhile, it's confirmed that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un traveled by train to Beijing yesterday, possibly his first trip outside his own country since assuming power, to meet with the Chinese president. China's state-run news agency reports Kim was committed to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and open to talks with the U.S. A meeting with President Trump is tentatively scheduled for May. So what's the politics and the importance of the Koreas in this moment? White House correspondent Scott Horsley is here. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you.
Start with a trade deal with South Korea. More American cars can go to South Korea. Less Korean steel, a lot less, can come to the U.S. Now, the president's backers and supporters say this is a big win for his America First mandate. And his threat of tariffs on steel and aluminum on South Korea, they say that leveraged this deal. Have they got a point?
It's certainly possible that the threat of tariffs on South Korea's steel exports made the leaders in Seoul more willing to negotiate in some of these other areas. South Korea is the number three supplier of foreign steel to the U.S. after Canada and Brazil. It accounts for about 10% of the steel that the United States imports. That steel would have been subject to a 25% tariff. Under this deal, South Korea gets permanent relief from that tariff, but in exchange, it has to reduce its exports of steel to the U.S. by about 30%. That is a win for domestic steel manufacturers. It may not be so good for U.S. businesses that use steel and now may face higher prices as a result.
Well, the New York Times is speculating that this may have been forced by the upcoming talks with the North. The idea that they wanted to get it done and it may not be able to be replicated. But what about the North's visit with China? Most North Korea watchers are saying anytime you can get Kim Jong-un out of his cloistered country, that's a good thing. But what is going on here politically with the White House? Are U.S. and Chinese officials working behind the scenes, do you think, or was the White House surprised? What does it mean?
No, I think China has been on more or less the same page with the United States in trying to put pressure on North Korea to take action with regard to its outlaw nuclear program. The White House says that the representatives of the Chinese government contacted them yesterday to kind of give them a readout on the meeting with Kim Jong-un, and that also included a personal message for President Trump, which was relayed. Now, China definitely has interest in North Korea and wants to make sure that in that tentative meeting with President Trump in May that, you know, China's not sort of left out of the deal. So this was an opportunity for China to sort of exercise its influence as well.
Well, as you know, the president's supposed to sit down with Kim, the North Korean leader, in May. Trump has called him Little Rockin' Man. He's called Trump an old lunatic and a dotard. His position, if we can believe the Chinese reporting, seems to have softened. So can the president's supporters also say that his blustering may have brought Kim to the table?
Whether it was his blustery rhetoric or the maximum economic pressure that's been put on North Korea by coordinated international sanctions, including sanctions from China, North Korea's longtime ally and its number one trading partner, all of that has certainly ratcheted up the pressure on Kim Jong-un to make some kind of deal. We did get an account from the Chinese news agency in which Kim said, if South Korea and the United States respond with goodwill to our efforts and create an atmosphere of peace and stability and take phased synchronized measures to achieve peace, then the issue of denuclearization on the peninsula can reach resolution. Well, that's a lot of ifs in there, and it's not entirely clear what that resolution he's talking about.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
A new MIT startup wants to help cities fight the opioid crisis by screening wastewater. Here's BioBot co-founder Nusha Gailey pitching the concept at South by Southwest.
Everybody pees every day. And this rich source of human health information aggregates in our public sewers. An infrastructure that you maintain, that you own, and that you manage. This resource is underutilized, and it's an untapped source of wealth and information.
Well, joining us now is Mike Bajorek. He is deputy town manager in Cary, North Carolina, that's testing this technology. Welcome to Here and Now, Mike. And let's start by telling us how the opioid crisis is affecting your town.
Well, last year, we in Cary, it's a city of about 162,000 people. We had 6 fatalities due to overdoses, an additional 40 overdoses that reversed through the use of Narcan. That was a 70% increase over the year before. And while that doesn't seem like a lot in numbers, first off, that was 46 families that were very much affected by it. But as our mayor states all the time, is that while we might not be in crisis, we are in a perfect position to actually try to do something about the opioid epidemic because of the situation that we're in.
Being proactive now, right?
Absolutely.
So along comes BioBot. I mean, first of all, what did you think of the idea when it was pitched to you, and how do you think it might be beneficial to Cary?
Well, I tell you, the first time when I've heard about measuring wastewater for opioid metabolites, I said, well, let's try that. And we failed miserably. So like any good bureaucrat, I said, okay, let's put that off to the side and try something else. But luckily, we have some great staff here with the town of Cary, and they continue to talk to people and got in touch with BioBot Analytics, who, while measuring of wastewater for opioid metabolites is not necessarily new, they're doing a lot of that in Europe, some in Australia. What's different about their thought is if we take it from small, more distinct geographic areas where we know the demographics and land use, a whole variety of other information because of the distinct area, will we be able to give our public health officials a more clear picture of what is going on?
But I wonder if there's concern on the flip side of that. I mean, have residents said that they're worried about their privacy, about whether or not if you're getting down to the area of a few blocks. I don't know how granular it can be. Mm-hmm. Are folks saying, you know, maybe we don't want town officials or city officials to know if we've got an opioid problem here?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I've had those questions asked me. And I guess the first thing I always start kind of on the big picture is in 2016, the CDC has said that over 64,000 fatalities were caused by drug overdoses. And if we have the opportunity to make a difference, why wouldn't we want to do it? Then the second thing is our smallest areas were about 10,000 people. 10,000 people in a day's time generates about over 500,000 gallons of wastewater, about an Olympic-sized pool worth of water over a day. And we'll be sampling about 10 gallons of that Olympic-sized pool. So it is thoroughly aggregated and would not be able to identify any one particular citizen.
Once you get that information, and I understand that you're doing it from maybe 10 different locations around Cary, say you find a spot where, you know, things look like maybe there's more opioids in the wastewater than you'd like to see. Does Cary have a plan for how it might go in and assist that part of the community?
Well, you know, this is not a police investigation tool. Our police have much better ways of understanding and finding where illegal drugs are going on than for us to be spending money measuring wastewater. What we hope to find is to get baselines for different areas to really do two things. If we get information or when we get information that illustrates a higher level of prescription opioid use than in other areas, or if there is illegal drugs going in an area, that is a great point to be able to have conversations. And that's what we're after, to have families talking about what's going on in their community, what's going on in their family. Now, the second piece is by giving this proactive information to our public health officials that currently are developing programs based on reactive data, basically number of overdose fatalities, stale data, it takes 6 months to a year to get an autopsy report that identifies what actually was the cause of death. I think through the information we're trying to develop, they'll be getting near real-time information about what is going on. And through predictive analytics and modeling, we hope that somebody way smarter than me will develop some correlations of saying, okay, if you look at this and this, then these actions will occur, and be able to give that information to our public health officials so that they can develop programs that specifically meet those parameters. They'll be more cost-effective, and they'll be able to respond quicker because we can remeasure. You know, this is a proactive program.
Mm-hmm.
What we're trying to do is not catch people once they're addicted. What we're trying to do is cut that addiction cycle before people are addicted. And so many more families will be saved and strengthened if we're successful in just starting the conversation.
Yeah.
Well, Mike Bajorek is Deputy Town Manager for Cary, North Carolina. Thank you so much.
Sure thing, Megan. Thanks for having me.
Facebook is simplifying its privacy settings. In a blog post today, the company said its privacy tools will be on one single page instead of 20. But calls to quit Facebook continue after those revelations that data from 50 million users got into the hands of the Steve Bannon-founded firm Cambridge Analytica, which worked for the Trump campaign to make targeted ads before the 2016 election. Actor Will Ferrell and Playboy magazine are the latest to announce they're leaving Facebook. Safe to say both will be missed by friends. But Esanay Okoha felt she really wasn't, and that told her a lot. She stopped using Facebook in 2016. She wrote about it on the publishing platform Medium. The title of her piece is, "It's been over a month since I left Facebook and nobody misses me." Esanay, hi.
Hi, how are you?
That's such a sad title right there.
I know. Well, I don't mince words, so.
Yeah, I guess not. Well, for start at the beginning, you joined in 2009. With what expectation?
Well, I was really excited because I am, you know, I'm from Nigeria. Mm-hmm. I'm American-born Nigerian, mm-hmm. so I'm Nigerian-American. And most of my relatives are still in Nigeria. A lot of I went to boarding school in Nigeria, and after we graduated, we all just kind of went our separate ways, and we're basically all over the place. Like they say, Nigerians, you can find us anywhere. And so when I found out that there was a platform where you can literally reconnect with people from your past, I obviously had to check it out. And I was excited about those connections that I was able to sort of revive over
sure.
time.
Be in touch. I mean, not everyone has a radio program, which is how I do it. I mean, I have to admit, I'm not on Facebook. You know, one of the reasons I'm just overwhelmed by some other social media, Twitter, et cetera, and people who need to reach me know where I am. But so for you,
right. Yeah,
it was this great way to reach people. So
yes. What
happened? Why'd you stop?
Well, I had a great handle on it in the beginning. It was more simplified, obviously, you know, especially being Nigerian. Nigeria, there's always, you know, not always good things happening. Mm. So you can always like connect with your loved ones and find out instantly how they're doing and weathering, you know, the latest upheavals. But then as it started to expand and grow, at first it was exciting and then it became actually kind of cold-hearted. You know, I felt even more disconnected.
And we've heard about this, that there's almost a competitiveness to it.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, when you're on the phone with someone, you aren't also looking at the pictures of their latest vacation in Morocco.
Oh, my God, yes.
I mean, you talked about how initially you could share with friends things you were weathering. And then you write, the images of other people's lives steadily started to reassure that life hadn't let them down nearly as much as you. I mean, there's this trying to match your own life against somebody else's.
Well, that's because I was going through some hard times professionally, and it just seemed as if you connect with these people and they're technically your friends, but it just didn't seem as if those connections were authentic. And, you know, they were only talking about what was happening to them, you know, the good things. And then I was sort of like on the outside trying to figure out how to, I guess, navigate that and still keep my sanity.
Right.
And so that was the problem. It just became more than what I'd signed up for. You know, I used to actually dread opening up my page because I had over 100 friend requests. And then when you think you've taken care of one issue, when you go to your settings tab, another issue pops up. It just seemed like I was losing control over a space that was supposedly mine. Mm-hmm. It wasn't my space anymore. It really belonged to Facebook.
And you ended up deactivating your account. Mm-hmm. So how does that feel?
Oh, I felt so much better. Instantly, I felt better. For one thing, I felt like I found myself again. And I didn't feel the pressure of having to be one person when I'm there and another person when I'm not there, meaning Facebook. Mm-hmm. And also it forced me to, reach out to the people that really mean something to me, you know, by calling them up. Mm-hmm. So it was just great to kind of start afresh.
Well, it also sounds like it's kind of bittersweet because in the beginning you had been suspecting some of these relationships that they weren't solid.
Oh, yeah.
And then when you came off, I mean, this goes back to your title, mm-hmm. you felt like, whoa, out of sight, out of mind?
Yeah. I mean, for me, you realize that you're not in the thick of it anymore. And some of my classmates from boarding school passed away. Well, not some, a couple passed away. And I didn't know until I found out, because maybe like 3 or 4 friends are on Instagram and they had mentioned it. And that's how I found out. So, yeah, it really did drive an even a deeper wedge between me and the people that I had reconnected with.
Because so far, not many of them have contacted you or bothered to contact you. But
only a couple of them did. Yeah. Only a couple of them did. And they were like, hey, Ezine, we haven't heard from you in a while. And I'm like, well, thank you for asking. And this is why. So, yeah.
Well, and as you watch, I mean, those are all issues of, emotional, cultural
preferences.
But, what about the latest story about privacy? I mean, how has that hit you?
Well, for one thing, I'm not surprised because I was always I was always kind of paranoid, because I'm naturally a private person. But when I first started on Facebook, I did get overly excited and, the headiness of it forced me to post a lot of my personal pictures. And so I think that is what Facebook, the people behind Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, that's what they wanted. They wanted people to just let their guard down and get really sucked into this thing. Mm-hmm. And of course they're going to use it. They're going to use it to figure out our behavioral patterns and to give us notices about friendship days. And, it's been 2 years since you've been friends with this person, to make you feel like, this is being done for your benefit when it's really being done to drive us crazy and to make us less human, I think. I think a lot of us are more bot-like now than human. To be honest, we're bots.
Ezine Ukoha, a writer who stopped using Facebook in 2016 because she'd become a bot, she says. Ezine, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. Well, earlier this month, a federal appeals court struck down Obama-era rules targeting unwanted robocalls, which means more spam might be coming your way soon. Spam calls are the number one consumer complaint to the Federal Communications Commission. Paul Flapp from Texas Public Radio tells us how fraudsters are flooding our phones, taking advantage of easy-to-dupe phone systems, and why robocalls are so hard to stop.
Recently, I got a call that my phone flagged in red, saying it was likely spam.
We have just received a notification regarding your tax filings.
They left a message saying they were with the IRS and I was in big trouble.
After that, you will be taken under custody by the local cops, as there are 4 serious allegations pressed on your name at this moment.
I deduced this was not really the IRS. 2.4 billion robocalls are made to U.S. consumers each month, says the FCC. Many are fraudsters who use an app or program to make it look like they're calling from another number.
So you can appear to be calling from the White House, the IRS, unfortunately, FBI or whatever. And unfortunately, there's not a lot that can be done about it right now.
Matthew Perry is the special agent in charge of cyber crimes at the FBI in San Antonio. This so-called spoofing is used mostly for financial gain, and when the calls are made domestically, the FBI has good results in responding. But Perry says overwhelmingly these calls originate overseas, where not much can be done.
Look at this.
For several years, law enforcement have dealt with swatting. That's where someone calls in a fake crime, often with a spoofed number. Popularized in the online gaming community, where live streaming gamers find themselves targets who are then raided by police. A handful of times, these pranks have had tragic results.
This is 911. What's going on?
Like this call in Wichita, Kansas, late last year. A California man called in saying he was holding his family hostage at a home in the city.
They were arguing and I shot him in the head and he's not breathing anymore.
28-year-old Andrew Finch, the man that lived at the address, was shot by Wichita police when they arrived expecting a hostage situation. Attempts to thwart spoofed calls have been mixed. The FCC proposed new rules in December to allow phone companies to block suspected calls. Several smartphone apps exist to help people identify scams, and crowdsourcing of user data has led to warnings like the one I got saying the call was suspect.
Because it's computer operated, you can place a lot of different calls with the same spoof number and have that occur in very large scale.
Lee Sutterfield is CEO at San Antonio-based telephony security company Secure Logics. They've been working on this issue for years and have received several grants around call authentication from the Department of Homeland Security. He says call authentication data is spread across old and new phone networks in a labyrinth of places.
How do you pull that together very rapidly? Within milliseconds, less than 1 or 2 seconds at the most.
His company rates the reliability of calls by red, yellow, and green for customers, mostly call centers for banks. Some banks, as well as the IRS, have increased screening as a result of last year's Equifax hack. Equifax exposed the information of more than 140 million Americans, a treasure trove of personal details. But even Sutterfield's bank still makes the mistake of using phone numbers as identifiers.
The first words out of their mouth still is, "Mr. Sutterfield, I see you're calling from an authorized phone number. How can I help you?"
Right now, Sutterfield says, a caller ID just isn't trustworthy. That's why telecom providers like AT&T, Verizon, and others want to roll out new standards that will make detecting spoofed calls easier. For Here and Now, I'm Paul Flav.
When C.C. Wong met his mom's new tenant, he never suspected he'd end up getting replaced as a son, or that his replacement might have sinister motives. This week, Invisibilia looks at the things we don't say to our loved ones and the misunderstandings it can lead to. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Craft beer has become a $70 billion industry and transformed the country's taste buds. But some states' alcohol laws haven't changed as quickly. That's the case in Maryland, where independent brewers are fighting to change longstanding laws so they can compete against neighboring Virginia. Ali Schweitzer from member station WAMU reports.
In the middle of downtown Silver Spring, Maryland, Denizen's Brewing Company is a throwback to America's manufacturing heyday. A forklift beeps as it sails past stacks of old-fashioned wooden barrels.
We have everything from tequila barrels to bourbon barrels to mezcal to white wine to rum.
Julie Verratti is Denizen's co-founder. She says the brewery ages beer in these barrels to come up with inventive new varieties, like a sour ale aged for 4.5 months in tequila barrels.
You name it. Basically, if it's had some sort of alcohol in it, we're going to age beer in it.
Craft brewing is creative that way, and Verratti says Maryland could see more of it if the state loosened regulations on breweries. Maryland has some of the strictest brewing laws in the nation. The state caps how much beer certain brewers can produce, how much they can sell out of their tap rooms, even how late they can stay open. Verratti says all those restrictions are stifling the industry, and that's not necessarily good for Maryland.
We're creating manufacturing jobs. Isn't that what every state wants? So why isn't Maryland fighting to keep those jobs and grow those jobs?
That's why Verratti and dozens of other Maryland brewers support a slew of new bills that would relax the state's brewing regulations. The legislation is nicknamed the Six Pack and it's backed by the Brewers Association of Maryland. The group is led by Kevin Addicks.
We have a bill that would expand the amount of beer that any brewery could produce. We have a bill that would expand the amount of beer our brewers could sell.
Addicks says his bills could help generate jobs, tourism dollars, and tax revenue for Maryland. But a similar bill, backed by the state's controller, was recently shot down in a House committee. And Addicks is facing opposition from Maryland's alcohol distributors and retailers, who contend that letting breweries sell and distribute more of their own beer threatens their businesses. But while the fight plays out in the General Assembly, Addicks says Maryland's craft beer industry is losing ground to its neighbors.
Every year, there are new regional and national brands that are coming out of these states' industries, and we're not seeing that in Maryland.
That concerns Maryland economic officials, who say Virginia is coming for their brewers. Cassidy Rasnick says that's the way the game is played. She works on commerce and trade for Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, and she says Maryland lawmakers need to wake up and smell the hops.
Some of the even biggest breweries in Maryland are really not too far from moving their brewery maybe 10, 15 miles and being in a state that is welcoming to them and isn't going to have a regulatory structure that is really kind of controlling the growth of their business.
Denizens Brewery's Julie Verratti, who's also the running mate of gubernatorial candidate Alec Ross, says Maryland should support small businesses as enthusiastically as it supports big businesses.
There's a lot of these big, massive Fortune 500 companies that the state will do backflips to try to get them in or get them to stay, and then they're hurting the local homegrown Maryland businesses.
Verratti says Maryland craft breweries are eager to expand and create more jobs for locals. Maryland just needs to open the taps and let the beer flow. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Schweitzer in Washington.
Saturday, the NCAA men's basketball Final Four will face off, starting with number 3 seed University of Michigan and 11th seed Loyola Chicago. Some are praying for the Loyola Ramblers. In fact, they have their own nun, Sister Jean, who's now the best-selling bobblehead of all time, and her Ramblers are the Cinderellas of March Madness. Why do Americans love underdogs so much? Let's get the backstory from Ed Ayers. Hi, Ed.
Hello.
And Brian Ballow. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Robin.
Historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Let's get the backstory on this. Ed, start with you. The underdog, a theme since when?
Well, I think ever since 13 scrappy colonies went up against the largest empire in the modern world. The beauty of America is everybody can think of themselves as an underdog in some way. You know, the only true ones were the indigenous people who had home court advantage but still ended up really suffering from all that. I think that, you know, it does seem to be something that's hardwired into the American psyche to somehow cheer for people who seem as if they are up against the odds.
Yeah, and Ed, I'm wondering, that sense of, you know, somebody's up against the odds, so there's almost a sense of, what, wanting a fairness?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what the country is really about. The American dream is everybody has a chance. And if you find that the underdogs don't have a chance, it kind of pokes holes in that dream.
Well, Brian, where do the actual words come from? You know, dark horse, underdog.
Well, dark horse comes from horse racing, and it didn't refer to the color, but it does refer to a lack of information about the horse. So you knew you were taking a bigger chance if you bet on that dark horse. And I think that sums up pretty well a whole range of what we call underdogs, whether they're presidential candidates, we're kind of not so sure we know about this guy, or whether it's figures in popular culture.
Well, talk about the not sure we know this guy. Some people might be surprised if they don't remember, you know, social studies. One of those dark horses was Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to turn that over to our Lincoln Prize winner, Ed Ayers.
Okay, well, we defer, Ed Ayers, with your two Lincoln Prizes. But remind us, we think, of course, now he's, you know,
He's Abraham Lincoln.
He's Abraham Lincoln, right?
Yeah.
But tell us when he was a dark horse.
Well, his whole life until he was elected president of the United States in many ways. I was just visiting the Lincoln Museum in Springfield, Illinois, and very interesting to see how it's presented. You walk into the museum and you take the left and you're going into the log cabin, and there's a three-dimensional life-size model of Abraham Lincoln reading by the fire while everybody else in his family is asleep, right? And then you kind of have to go through that world of when he works in a store and you see his pant legs are too short and his shirt sleeves are too short. As much space is spent on representing Abraham Lincoln as an underdog as is spent on portraying him as the most powerful person in the United States.
I love the fact that you guys that were, you know, talking about Abraham Lincoln as the underdog, the dark horse, in the same segment that was prompted by Loyola.
It is Illinois, Robin.
Right. I love that. But do you think that this is something of the past? Because now we have, well, I guess we do have underdogs. I mean, Donald Trump was considered an underdog, and yet he's not. He doesn't have poor beginnings.
Absolutely. We have people like Harry S. Truman, really came from a pretty impoverished background, was pretty unsuccessful himself in his business endeavors, and absolutely was not expected to win in the election of 1948. In fact, the most iconic photograph of Harry S. Truman is him holding up the newspaper saying that his opponent, Dewey, wins the election, which of course he didn't. Truman won. On the other hand, we have people like Donald Trump, who has styled himself as an underdog. I mean, in fact, Donald Trump came from quite a wealthy background, but he's somebody who feels no matter what kind of advantage he has in politics, the whole system is rigged against him. I don't think you can understand Donald Trump unless you understand that the vast majority of people who voted for Clinton came from counties where the economy is contributing a disproportionate amount to the GDP. And those who voted for Trump came from counties where they live is underrepresented in America's economy. They are literally underdogs. They feel underrepresented.
But Ed, back to sports. Give us another example of, I mean, there's so many, but underdogs.
Well, the Olympics are great because somehow we can be the most powerful nation in the world and still feel like we're not really respected as we should be in one sport or another. I think we look back on the underdog of Jesse Owens in the 1936 Olympics against Hitler. And not only is America winning, but the people who are perpetual underdogs in America overcome these obstacles to win. And then you go all the way up into the Miracle on Ice, in which a ragtag team of American hockey players beat the powerful Red Machine of the Soviet Union. And we've played lots of games over the years, but interesting how we transpose this sports underdogness in some ways to geopolitical standing as well.
I'm just wondering, we are embracing this as an American tradition and way of thinking. Don't other countries also root for the underdog?
I do think it's human nature to root for underdogs, but I would argue there is something in American history probably pretty connected to not having an aristocracy or a ruling class, as you were talking about earlier, that makes us feel that, you know, we all come from an even playing field and the best man or woman should win the race.
Okay, so bring us back to this year's March Madness. What's your sense of this whole season?
You know, being a historian, I want to talk about Loyola Chicago in a little more historical depth. I don't know if people remember, but they've been here before, and they were even larger underdogs because they had the audacity, if you can imagine this, to put four African-American players on the floor at the same time when there was a kind of unspoken agreement that a team would play no more than three at a time. And then in the early 1960s, they win the national championship with four African-American players. Mm. And it's interesting that we now just think of them as being from a small conference or a small school or whatever, or we think about Sister Jean. But you could also see them as sort of a vehicle by which college basketball and American sports kind of integrated itself.
And Ed always ends on an uplifting note. I'm going to point out a somewhat depressing note. I think the exception to Americans always rooting for the underdog is that has not been the case when it has come to a majority of Americans rooting for African Americans. I think quite often we found white Americans rooting for white athletes to beat African American athletes in whatever sport it was internally. Now, Ed's right. When America goes to the Olympics and we're fighting against the Nazis or the competing against the Nazis, we can get behind Jesse Owens. But whether it's Jackie Robinson making his way up through the major leagues or any of the heroic stories of African Americans against the odds, people were not rooting for the underdog, meaning the majority of American people.
It is our flaw. I want to mention one other team that was underdog, and as you were saying, Ed, it's just a team that was the huge underdog, and it won. It went pretty far, but then people realized, oh, not only was it great athletically, but it's a great school academically, far beyond the expectations for it, and that was the Maryland-Baltimore County, UMBC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm in the world of higher education, and I've been a big fan of UMBC for a long time. Freeman Hrabowski, their president, has really set the standard for the whole country in producing African-American PhDs. And so that's, you know, the dream that all of us have who are in higher education. There's going to be some moment when they turn away from the game and say something about the university. And I think that's another thing that makes this resonate so much for Americans. You're not just pulling for a professional team. These are places that are located somewhere that are pulling players from a place with a particular identity. And I think it helps a lot when you're playing against places that have so-called blue blood. Now, that's an interesting phrase that people use in the sports pages, to talk about a sports team as if it's an aristocrat blue blood, which I think only turns up the underdog motif on people who are not blue bloods.
Bringing us with the aristocrats and the blue bloods back to the origins of the country and the overthrowing of the aristocrats. That's Ed Ayers. We've also been speaking with Brian Ballow, historians, co-host of the weekly podcast Backstory. Ed, Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Nearly one-fifth of women in Japanese prisons are over 65. They're the fastest-growing prison demographic in the country, and they're committing minor crimes in the hopes of going to prison. Emiko Takagi is professor of gerontology at San Francisco State University, and she joins us. Welcome, professor.
Thank you for having me.
How bad is it for elderly women in Japan if prison seems to be a better option for them?
Well, Japan has a mixture of good examples of healthy aging and active aging, and also the social isolation and loneliness.
Right.
So there's this anxiety and insecurity about growing old. Women are more likely to outlive their husbands, therefore, you know, having more years, you know, to be living by themselves. And then, you know, it seems to be some women are, older women are trying to, you know, get to this last resort, you know, to commit up, you know, petty thefts and then, you know, go to prison.
Are we seeing something similar amongst elderly men in Japan?
There is, I think, a concern about aging population in prisons in general. So the government is trying to get some policies and programs and going on to assist those older adults who are either in the prisons or just, you know, recently released from prisons. But men and women probably have a little bit of different situations because, like I said before, the men are more likely to have a living spouse. So at least they have a little bit of safety in that, you know, when they are at home, you know, somebody who's, you know, who can cook for you and then comfort you. Whereas, you know, older women are more likely to outlive, you know, their husbands. Therefore, you know, there's more years, you know, to be on their own.
Right. Now, I'm seeing here that more than a quarter of Japan's current population is over 65, and the population continues to age. So, I mean, is this a challenge that's only likely to grow, it seems?
Yes. Well, the projection is that in a couple of decades that it's going to be closer to 40% of the population is going to be over the age of 65.
Wow.
So it's a real public health policy concerns. So there's a real financial strain on their pension system and also the healthcare systems, too.
But Japan has tried to do things to provide additional support for these senior women who are recidivists in a sense, right? I mean, in order to get them welfare and social service assistance that might help them. But I'm also seeing here that some people think that the the fundamental problems that are leading these women to commit these crimes is they say it's out of reach of what the government can do. Would you agree with that?
To some extent, I do agree, because I think the core problem they're having, it's not necessarily about the services, you know, that, you know, they're maybe lacking. That's probably a part of a problem. But I think it's the sense of loneliness and then the disconnect, you know, with the rest of the society. The relationships, you know, they can, you know, really enjoy and then, you know, help them, you know, to have a fulfilling life. So that's something that, you know, that just a social service can provide easily. There has to be a cultural change, you know, to understand what they're going through. If you go to a bookstore in Japan, for example, there's a lot of self-books, you know, telling people about how to think about their later life. And so, you know, there's certain, I think, cultural movement, you know, to create a new expectations about, you know, how to grow older, because now the traditional life course perspective doesn't really fit into what's really happening, right? You know, beyond the age of 65, you have 20, 30, 40 years sometimes, you know, to live. And then we don't really have the cultural framework, you know, to, you know, tell you that this is how you're supposed to be living your life. There's a lot of public talks about, you know, maybe shifting that, the way we think about, you know, the life beyond, you know, the certain age, like 65.
It seems as if a prison is essentially, for many of these women, is playing mm-hmm. the role of what an assisted living facility would be mm-hmm. playing, right? Or some sort of senior living community would be playing.
Right. Yeah. Right. Assisted living provides both healthcare services and then to some extent social opportunities. And then a lot of older women in the prison are saying about, for the first time, you know, I'm enjoying the role, you know, they're playing, you know, they enjoy working in prisons. And then they enjoy the time, you know, having people, you know, around them. And then also, you know, some tangible services like nutritional meals. In some ways that the services they're getting at the service, not the services, but programs they're getting, you know, in prisons, is fulfilling some of the needs, you know, they are not really, you know, having to, you know, satisfied, you know, in their own homes.
Right. I mean, it makes me think that perhaps part of the solution is to create those opportunities outside of prison.
Mm-hmm. Right. There are meals programs, there are social service programs, but older adults have to go out and then reach out to those service agencies mm-hmm. too. And then I think the outreach project, you know, the efforts, you know, have to be made more to those older adults. They may not be necessarily aware of, you know, what's available in their communities, or they may not be really understand that there are some people, you know, who are willing to listen to them. So that's, I think, something that they have to work on.
Yeah. Well, Emiko Takagi is a professor of gerontology at San Francisco State University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. And that's one of the saddest things I've ever heard. And this is Here and Now.